Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Joanna Hernandez. Brandis Freeman is on assignment. Here's what we're looking at.
Perverse incentive that social media companies seem to have to keep kids scrolling.
How Illinois lawmakers are working to change how youth access social media. Refusing to pay federal income taxes is growing in popularity as a form of protest. But what are the risks?
There were many of those young people.
And a first for Wrigleyville, a bar dedicated to women's sports. We talk with the owner about her game plan. Shootings in Chicago so far this year are up over last year's historic lows. Through the first 4 months of 2026, there has been 130 homicides, up 8% compared to this time last year. There's also been 421 shootings, a 6% increase over 2025. But data from the Chicago Police Department also shows a 33% decline in armed robberies and a 15% drop in carjackings year to date. And violent crime on the CTA is also down 15%. For more on the latest citywide crime stats, you can visit our website. Hundreds and thousands of people brought to the U.S. as children are now at the center of an immigration fight. Today, advocates held a news conference alongside Senator Dick Durbin, warning the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, better known as DACA, could be in jeopardy. It comes as hundreds of recipients report delays in DACA renewals. Other people have faced deportation after a recent decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals saying DACA status alone is not enough to stop someone from being deported. Created under the Obama administration, DACA has protected more than 800,000 people and provided work authorization. Durbin says recipients undergo rigorous background checks, and many are building careers and families in the U.S., pushing back on claims that portray the so-called Dreamers as a public safety threat.
We've opened 101 cases in our office, 101 cases of DACA recipients who are struggling now to be renewed.
The Department of Homeland Security recently disclosed last year that ICE deported dozens of DACA beneficiaries and detained over 300. And then last week, the Department of Justice's Board of Immigration Appeals issued a decision that could lay the groundwork for ICE to be able to deport more DACA recipients.
The future of DACA remains in the hands of the court as legal challenges continue to move forward. And tickets for the highly anticipated opening of the Obama Presidential Center are going on sale tomorrow morning. But be ready, they're expected to go fast. It comes after nearly 5 years of construction on the project in Jackson Park. The center will officially open to the public on Juneteenth, with planned events scheduled throughout the holiday weekend. General admission tickets for Illinois residents are $26 for those 12 and up, and $15 for children under 12. The museum will also be free for Illinois residents every Tuesday. The center has exhibits across four floors and includes a full-size replica of President Obama's Oval Office. Tickets are required to visit the museum, but the surrounding area, including gardens, art installations, and a playground, is free and open to the public. Tickets go on sale tomorrow at 9 a.m. Up next, calls to regulate how children use social media. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
We've been using social media, there's been a debate over how you should be able to access it. On one hand, addictive feeds keep kids scrolling endlessly and can harm their mental health. On the other hand, social media can give young people spaces for expression that aren't available in school or at home. Whether you see it as a force for good, bad, or somewhere in between, calls to regulate social platforms have spread across the nation. That includes here in Illinois. Joining us here to talk about all that is Jessica Schleider, professor of medical social sciences at Northwestern University, Ed Yonka, director of communications and public policy at the ACLU of Illinois, and State Representative Jennifer Gongart-Schwitz, whose district includes parts of Glenview, Wilmette, and Skokie. Thank you all for joining us. This is an important topic because I feel like we live live in the era of social media now. Can you believe that?
Truly.
Now, Jessica, I want to start with you. What are some ways that social media can impact youth mental health positively and negatively, you would say?
And I really appreciate the framing of the question as both positively and negatively, because it is a really complex relationship. Mm-hmm. Screen time alone, time spent on social media, doesn't correlate very cleanly with youth mental health outcomes. What does correlate with youth mental health outcomes are how young people actually use the platform. Certainly the architecture behind the platform, infinite scroll, these harmful algorithmic feeds, that can really undermine youth mental health, particularly for young people who are already at risk. At the same time, social media platforms are often the first and sometimes only place that young people actually seek out mental health support and connection. I'm a child and adolescent clinical psychologist. I study interventions that can be deployed through social media platforms to meet youth where they're actually first seeking help. And the potential, the population health potential of these platforms, if leveraged properly, is really tremendous for promoting youth mental health. But as they're currently designed, that really isn't being accomplished because these companies are allowed to create platforms that are, you know, incentivizing kids to stay on them at all costs.
So you're really saying there's pros and cons here?
There's absolutely pros and cons, and I think they can be leveraged for good if supported in doing that, but currently they're not.
And Representative Gon Gershowitz, would you argue that social media platforms need to be regulated?
Yes, in fact, I've introduced and passed legislation out of the House of Representatives that does exactly that. And we believe that by targeting the most harmful features on these social media platforms, that we're striking the right balance between protecting kids' mental health while also allowing some of the good things that the professor just outlined.
And Representative, why would you say that you think regulating social media has bipartisan interest?
Well, I think there's been a watershed of understanding by parents about the downsides of social media addiction and the impacts that this has on our kids' mental health. And so this is really not a partisan issue. This is a bipartisan concern, I think, shared by just about every parent and, frankly, by kids themselves. I'm a mom of three boys, and I hear from my kids concerns about not being able to put that phone down, a feeling like they're glued to their screens. And honestly, what this bill is attempting to do is to target those design features that we find most harmful to kids.
And then what are your thoughts? You argue that preserving youth access to social media is important. Why is that?
You know, I think part of the reason that we're concerned is because that access is really an important First Amendment right to get access to information. We think so much about the First Amendment being about what I can say, right? But it's also about the information I can get. I think one of the things you hear in this discussion is concern about these platforms, but I think whether or not it's the right solution to have government decide what information is available and to whom is the place where we just sort of depart in looking at a solution. Because in fact, as the professor points out, there are people who are finding and young people who are finding solutions to the challenges that they face through these online platforms. And so how do we balance those things and make sure that we aren't limiting expression or access to information while at the same time addressing the worst and most harmful features that I think everybody widely agrees on?
You know, this is really interesting because we all have kids here. You're a grandfather yourself,
yes.
Yourself, Ed. Jessica, I want to talk a little bit about what Australia is doing. They recently banned youth under 16 from using social media. Are outright bans of youth on social media effective?
So this is, I think, a very common impulse, right, to just say, okay, no more adolescents on social media because of these harms that are being identified. And unfortunately, I don't think these are helpful solutions, even though they're being very widely implemented. And I actually really appreciate that this bill in Illinois is not doing a blanket ban, but instead targeting the design features that actually undermine youth mental health. And in Australia, not only is the ban ineffective because youth are really tech savvy, they will find ways around this ban.
Especially in this area, you would say.
Absolutely, because they're motivated to do so, but they'll simply find themselves into less regulated portions of the internet and maybe even be less safe that way. But we're really letting platforms off the hook if we focus on bans. Essentially, we're saying
you should go after the the social, like the companies.
Precisely. Create guardrails that have good implementation power, that have good stickiness, and force these companies to create platforms that can be leveraged for good. By banning young people from these platforms altogether, it essentially gives them a free pass not to change what's wrong with the platforms. However, those regulations have to have teeth. And I think the implementation of regulations on these platforms is going to be the real challenge to figure out how to actually make them stick.
And Representative, you talked a little bit about it, but you are the chief sponsor on that bill called the Children's Social Media Safety Act in Illinois. Can you break it down for me a little bit more on what it's regulating and what it's doing?
Yeah, thank you. So this bill primarily does three things, and it does not regulate content. It targets the most harmful features that we see causing problems online. So it stops addictive algorithmic feeds. It disallows and prevents social media companies from essentially weaponizing your own information to curate content that keeps you glued to your screen. It also stops location sharing, as well as those scam financial transactions with strangers online, as well as in the middle of the night notifications. So we think that by targeting the harmful design features, such as algorithmic feeds that are designed to be addictive, they are addictive by design, we can address the most harmful features of social media platforms without restricting content.
Ed, what are your thoughts on that? Because we know once you can click on something right on social media, and then the algorithm starts just spewing that contact.
And this is where I think we're still looking for a balance that involves, you know, a solution that maybe isn't a governmental solution. In one of the things like the Trevor Project and other people who work with LGBTQ youth tell us is that sometimes that algorithmic feed, once a young person starts searching, they may find information in a non-supportive home that may be very important for them in terms of reaching a safe and healthy outcome for their life. And so I think it's, you know, again, I think this discussion just says that, A, we need to continue to find a balance. But I think that the point that the professor made earlier, you know, we shouldn't forget that the people, essentially the billionaires who control these algorithms were all placed up front at the inauguration last year. Mm-hmm. They are getting off the hook scot-free without being responsible for doing any of this. And frankly, you know, I think, you know, broader education on the harms of this, broader education, I think, on some of the more corrosive factors that parents and others could look out for, and putting as consumers pressure on those folks to make changes, I think is another way to go.
Yeah. And Jessica, we only have a couple seconds, but again, we mentioned you also have a young child, as so do I. You know, what do you hope social media looks like for youth 10, 15 years from now?
I really hope that the potential of these algorithms to connect people with resources that are well-timed for their needs, and the potential of these platforms that reach unprecedented numbers of young people to actually deliver supports in real time based on what they're searching for, that are evidence-based, that are effective. That is the social media universe that I hope exists, not just one that takes advantage of young people's attention, but that actually leverages this tremendous platform for the public health opportunity that it is.
Well, thank you. We're gonna have to leave it at that, but thank you for all of your input. Up next, a growing protest against the federal government withholding federal tax payments. Some Chicagoans are choosing a new way to protest the Trump administration. Instead of taking to the streets, some people are letting their wallets do the talking by refusing to pay federal taxes. The action is called tax resistance, and it has grown in popularity following the country's handling of the war in Gaza and the conflict in Iran. But of course, it's not without its risks. Here to break it all down for us is M. Jacoby, fund manager with the New England War Tax Resistance, and Genevieve Tokic, Associate Director of the Tax Program and Professor of Instruction in Law of Northwestern's Law School. Now, thank you both for joining us. I was not knowledgeable about this type of resistance, I have to tell you. So can you break it down for us and tell us a bit about what is tax resistance and how do people practice it?
Yeah, so war tax resistance, we're a group of people that we don't disagree with taxing, okay? Mm-hmm. We actually want to pay our taxes, but we want them to go back into the communities mm-hmm. that we live in. We want to see this money benefit our neighbors, and we're against war. So 53%, the War Resisters League puts out a pie chart every year of the federal budget, and 53% of it goes to military spending. So war tax resistors say, this isn't right. We don't want all this money going to war. There's many different ways to do it. Some people live below the taxable income. They live simply in order to not pay taxes
at all.
So
it's almost like creating a plan.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. Some people, what they'll do is they'll file their taxes and they'll pay a portion of it. Sometimes they'll pay, 47%. They'll go with the pie chart for that year and go with that amount. Other people will file and they won't pay anything at all. And they often include a letter to the IRS. If you don't pay the full amount to the IRS in any way, in any deduction from what you owe, it is handled by a person, not a machine. Yeah. And so it's a way to get notice and to just speak your mind.
I want to bring Genevieve in. Genevieve, I want to bring you in. If you don't pay your taxes, we know you can get in a lot of big trouble. So including going to prison. What's at stake here legally?
Yeah, so I think, we just heard that there's a number of different forms of tax resistance. Mm-hmm. And things like reducing your income so that you pay the federal government less taxes is perfectly legal. There's no requirement that you earn a certain amount of money. But there are rules about once you do earn a certain level of income, you have to pay income taxes. And if you don't do that, there are both civil penalties and the potential for criminal proceedings if you're found to be guilty of willful tax evasion. But things like paying a portion of your taxes might reduce the penalties, but you're still not kind of off the hook. So there's a number of different things I've heard about. We have things like penalties for failure to file your tax return, but you can file a tax return and still not pay your taxes, and then you're avoiding the failure to file penalties, but still potentially subject to the failure to pay penalties. And of course, the IRS will also come after you potentially for interest on unpaid taxes.
And Genevieve, but of course, you can understand why people would want to be part of this movement, you would say.
Well, yes. I mean, there's a long history of sort of tax resistance as a form of civil disobedience or protest in the United States. This was actually, it goes way back really to even before the founding of the United States, right, to the colonial era. There was tax resistance to the British government. There were abolitionists who used tax resistance mm-hmm. to protest slavery. Famously, I think, the author Henry David Thoreau refused to pay taxes for some years in a protest against slavery and also the Mexican-American War back in the 1800s. So this is something that is not unusual, and taxes are such a key part of citizenship, if you will, right? The role of the government, taxes are important to raising revenue, and so it is a powerful form of protest. But again, there are serious risks because not paying taxes is illegal.
And Em, I want to bring you in. We just mentioned about the history of this. Now, you work for the New England War Tax Resistance, the organization started in 1968, following the Vietnam War. Tell us a bit about the organization's history and why you think it's still relevant to this day.
Yeah, so I work for a board of directors that consists of people that have been war tax resistors from between 25 and 40 years. Mm. These people are active in their communities, trying to make change and support local organizations, the organizations that they would like their taxes to be supporting. And we're at a moment where they're brokenhearted. They're brokenhearted that, like, in the 25 to 40 years of resistance that they've been doing, they haven't seen improvement in U.S. policy abroad. And so in this moment, they're grateful for, like, the growth of the war tax resistor movement. They're grateful for more people coming into this. But they're also, like, really sad to be at this point where we need growth in this movement.
And, you know, why do you think this particular form of civil disobedience is important?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many ways to resist, you know, this administration or the policies, the immigration raids, the war in Iran, the war in Palestine. But this is something that is, like, deeply personal. It is a commitment between you and the IRS, the federal government. And so this is something that, like, we don't even exactly know how big this movement is because it is personal.
But you are seeing an increase in users or just people reaching out.
Yes, we're seeing more people that are asking for help protecting financial assets in case that they are levied by the U.S. government for their war tax resistance. We're seeing people jump in and say, hey, I want to learn more and I want to understand the risks because I'm at a point where I am ready to take risks to make change.
And Genevieve, we only have a couple seconds. What are your final thoughts?
Yeah, just, you know, one point is that not everyone can resist paying taxes. People who are paid a salary from an employer, their taxes are remitted by their employer. And so tax resistance isn't an option for everyone. And even for people who do choose to go that route, right, there are serious potential consequences. And so, you know, it is important to think about maybe other ways of expressing dissatisfaction with the government and the way that the government is spending taxes, right? And of course, our most important voice, I think, as citizens is the ability to vote.
Genevieve, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it at that. Sure. I apologize, but thank you. Thank you for both of your inputs.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Up next, a new bar dedicated to fans of women's sports. The WNBA season tips off this Friday, and soon there'll be a new place in Chicago to watch those games and other women's sports. We spoke with the owner of a new bar opening in Wrigleyville and got a sneak peek at her game plan.
Hi, my name's Clarissa Flores. Welcome to Level Sporting Club.
It's under construction now, but soon this site in Wrigleyville will be all about women's sports all the time.
The norm is now walking into a sports bar and it's a men's game and you have to ask for the women's game.
But at this bar, women's sports is taking center court.
I was going through a lot of different names, but for me, Level stood out the most because I'm here to level the playing field for women's sports.
Steps away from Wrigley Field, Flores is tapping into a fan base she says is already here.
Wrigleyville is the entertainment district of Chicago, and I wanted to take my seat where we belong. I didn't want to be in the outskirts. People don't realize this, but the majority of the fans that go to Wrigley are women.
Flores is an athlete herself. She played Division I basketball at Northwestern University.
I'll say it till I'm blue in the face. My whole life and my whole career is indebted to the sport of basketball. And you know what we're experiencing right now, not just here, which I'm trying to contribute to, but we're experiencing a cultural shift. And that cultural shift is towards women's sports.
So tell me a little bit about the vision of this first level.
Yeah, so the first level up here is gonna be where all the action's at. Upbeat sports bar, music, vibe, food, TVs. You know, it's the whole shebang up here.
And downstairs, a completely different game plan.
So this is gonna be my lower level key club. I'm gonna have a piano player down here, sing-along piano vibe where the piano player is playing Eminem, Beyonce. It'll be a high energy vibe, but on a piano. It'll be sexier, loungier, candlelit, darker type of vibe. So if you're trying to do like a date night, you come down here. If you want all the fun and excitement, you go upstairs. So two
different She's vibes. Stepping into one of the fastest growing audiences in sports, backed by a strong roster of women investors.
My team that I built was intentional. Jennifer King, who coached the Chicago Bears, was a running back coach, and the Washington Commanders. Ashleen Bracey, who's a head coach of UIC women's basketball. I have an MIT basketball player. I have a University of Chicago soccer player. My culinary partner is a two-time Bib Gourmand chef who played soccer for the University of Texas. What I'm doing now is for the communities, the LGBT community, the women's sports community. That's a culture that I'm trying to build up now.
She says basketball has opened doors for her, and now she wants to give that same opportunity to the next generation.
Hopefully in doing this, you know, it gives, you know, younger girls that are growing up, hey, women's sports can sustain a business, or hey, I can make a career out of women's sports. To be able to give back is amazing.
Very excited, very exciting for that neighborhood. Now, Level Sporting Club is set to open at the end of the month. To learn more, visit our website. And that's our show this Tuesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, there's a new cooking show, Indian as Apple Pie. It's showcasing delicious recipes in rich culture. Now, from all of us here in Chicago tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.